It is Thursday, November 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, we look at new efforts to try to end Syria's civil war. The United Nations Special Envoy for Yemen believes peace talks will begin soon. We get reaction from a former American ambassador to Yemen.
I think both parties are trying to cement the positions they have on the ground and perhaps even claim more territory, greater leverage, and more momentum. So when they go into the talks, they'll be in a position of greater authority.
And a new documentary looks at the life of Real Madrid star Cristiano Ronaldo. It's all ahead. A second round of international talks is scheduled in Vienna Saturday on ways to end the nearly five-year-old Syrian civil war. A key item is expected to be how to decide which opposition groups Damascus is willing to negotiate. In a communique following last month's first round, the 17 world powers, the UN and the EU, agreed on the importance of accelerating diplomatic efforts to end the conflict and a UN-led effort to reach a ceasefire. Regional analyst David Lesh of Trinity University in Texas tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, while the future of President Bashar al-Assad also remains a key obstacle to peace, the opposition remains fragmented.
And finding a so-called acceptable opposition, certainly to the Syrian government and its supporters, Iran and Russia, any of those that have been deemed as terrorists, which is almost anybody fighting the Syrian government, are deemed as unacceptable. What's interesting is that many of those are also deemed unacceptable by a number of countries in the West, including the United States, such as Ahrar al-Sham, which many would say is a radical Islamist group that is kind of a homegrown version of Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda branch in Syria. And of course, groups like ISIS are totally off the table. So finding an acceptable opposition, if you just get the opposition that the Russians want or that the Syrian government is willing to negotiate with, you have very little legitimacy amongst those Syrian opposition who have been fighting and dying for almost 5 years now. You know, that's a very small portion of the opposition. The crux of any political settlement depends on whether or not you can get the Syrian government to agree to concessions that are constitutionally encoded without caveat that can satisfy at least the minimum demands of a critical mass of the opposition. I just don't think there's any way right now that the Vienna talks and the list that people are drawing up are going to come up with a critical mass of the opposition who can bring enough of the opposition to the table, particularly, you know, via a ceasefire, which seems to be what everyone's working for before you even get to, you know, the many issues that divide Syrians today. But can you get enough of them to the table at all? And I don't think you can right now.
How can the West and Russia come to an agreement on the opposition?
Well, it's going to be a lot of horse trading. Each side at some point have to make concessions. With regard to who they deem the acceptable opposition, acceptable in terms of being an opposition group with whom the Syrian government could agree to negotiate with. Right now, the Syrian government, basically anybody that's fighting it, is a terrorist group. And Russia has, and to a certain degree Iran, has adopted that same definition. So the Russians and the Syrian government and the Iranians, and particularly the Russians and Iranians, probably have to put pressure on the Syrian government to open the net wider in terms of who is an acceptable opposition. And I think the West will as well. I think the United States and European countries will have to accept certain armed Islamist opposition groups that aren't Jabhat al-Nusra, that aren't ISIS, as negotiating partners, or else you're just not going to reach that critical mass.
David, there appears to be a Russian proposal that is being circulated that calls for drafting a new constitution within 18 months. Put to a popular referendum, followed by early presidential elections, but it makes no mention of President Bashar al-Assad stepping down during any transition period. What do you make of that?
They're trying, I think, the Russians to, through early elections, bring some legitimacy to Bashar al-Assad. And, of course, many in the West and many players in the region, you know, want to see quite the opposite.
That's David Lesh of Trinity University in Texas. He says the burden is on Damascus to state what political reforms it's prepared to discuss including amendments to the Constitution. That, he says, must be preceded by a ceasefire. Meanwhile, Lesh suspects Russia is disappointed. Its military intervention is not translated into more victories by the Syrian army, backed by Iran and Hezbollah. He says opposition forces faced with Russian airstrikes have stiffened their resolve and received more assistance from Gulf Arab states. Well, looking at social media, Reuters reports that Syria looms large as the leaders of the group of 20 major economies meet on Sunday and Monday in Turkey. The summit is actually taking place just about 500 kilometers from the Syrian border. The leaders are expected to discuss terrorism and the European migration crisis. The head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, said in a blog that the migration situation will be a focal point of the talks. Some officials have said this is only the second time in its history that the G20 will formally deal with issues outside of economic policy. Well, Reuters also reports that at least 100 soldiers and fighters were killed in northern Syria in fighting earlier this week as Syrian government forces reached an airbase held by the Islamic State. It says most of those killed were IS militants. And Euronews reports that Jordan's King Abdullah says his country is maxed out by providing asylum to Syrian refugees. He says his country has taken in roughly 1.4 million Syrian refugees. That's about 20% of Jordan's population. U.S. News and World Report speculates that Russian President Putin may have overplayed his hand in Syria. It says the world is waiting to see what the Russian leader will do following the recent downing of a Russian plane in Egypt. Militants claiming affiliation with IS claimed responsibility for last month's downing of the Russian airliner in the Sinai Peninsula, saying it was revenge for Russian airstrikes on targets in Syria. All 224 people on board the flight were killed. The head of Egypt's investigation team says no conclusions have been reached about what brought the airliner down. Well, on a lighter note, American film star George Clooney is getting a lot of tweets today. That's because he's visiting Edinburgh, Scotland, to support the plight of homeless people there. He sparked a frenzy at a cafe that helps the homeless. You can look it up on hashtag George Clooney. And that's a look at social media. The UN Special Envoy for Yemen said he was confident that peace talks between the government and Houthi rebels will probably be held in mid-November in Geneva. Ismail Weld Sheikh Ahmed said his team was in contact with the Yemeni parties to discuss the modalities of the UN-brokered peace talks. However, the warring parties are relentlessly escalating the fighting. International Edition senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi spoke with Steve Sesh, a former U.S. ambassador to Yemen, to analyze the situation. Mohammed, if the parties agreed to send representatives to the peace talks, why is the escalation?
Usually, Sarah, in a situation like this, parties are trying to get the best gains before negotiations start, as Ambassador Sesh explains.
I think both parties are trying to cement the positions they have on the ground and perhaps even claim more territory, greater leverage, and more momentum. So when they go into the talks, they'll be in a position of greater authority, if you will, to be able to try to extract some concessions from the other side. I hope this doesn't suggest a lack of commitment on the part of each side, because each side has said it will send representatives to the talks once they are underway.
Ambassador Sesh argued that the involvement of Saudi-led coalition in the Yemeni conflict helped indeed in facilitating an opening to a possible negotiated settlement by forcing the Houthis and their allies to retreat and accept the 7-point peace plan brokered by the UN. However, he said, the real test now is how to implement it.
Well, I certainly think that this is the crux of the matter now. What is going to be the blueprint, if you will, the roadmap by which central authority, a legitimate authority, will be reestablished in Yemen, a central authority in Sana'a, It may begin in Aden as it is already, but it may also then need to shift back to the capital in Sana'a and have the world begin to see with some confidence that a government is once again in place. And I think this is also part and parcel of the issue of how do the fighters then, the Houthi fighters and others, withdraw from the cities, pull back to more neutral locations so they're not seen as a threat to the composition of this government.
Mohammed, usually peace talks following a conflict need outside encouragement, if not pressure, to produce results. What kind of steps are needed to improve chances for a successful conclusion of these talks?
Well, according to Ambassador Sesh, negotiating in good faith is a must. But also, all parties should pitch in to facilitate a long-awaited end to the Yemeni conflict.
I think all the parties to the conflict need to be serious and committed at this point. And I think the international community needs to demonstrate and articulate its support for the negotiations. That means the United States, that means Russia, it means Iran, it means the GCC neighbors. Every party in the conflict and close to the conflict needs to make very clear what their intentions are and what they see as the only possible solution to this. And so I think that it is a moment now, a critical moment. If this opportunity slips by without the talks convening in the middle of November, I'm not sure when there will be another chance to bring the parties together. But the kind of disposition they've shown to move into the negotiations now without the preconditions that I think would be very difficult to see people meet.
Thank you, Mohammed, for the update.
Thank you, Sarah, for having me.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Paleontologists have discovered a giant, ancient, and feathered relative of today's birds. Called the Dakota Raptor, this new species is the big cousin of the Velociraptor, which was made famous in the Jurassic Park movies. The researchers who made the discovery of this ancient predator say that the creature is the largest specimen ever found with wing feathers. The giant raptor is thought to have been a little over 5 meters long, which would make it one of the largest raptors in the world. The creature lived about 65 million years ago during the Cretaceous period. The researchers say that this predatory dinosaur was lightly built and probably just as agile as their cousin, the brutal but smaller Velociraptor. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a new documentary takes us into the personal life of soccer star Ronaldo. White and Asian students in the United States continue to outperform their Black and Latin counterparts nationwide. That's the conclusion of a U.S. Department of Education 2015 report card assessing nationwide student achievement. Elizabeth Lee examines some of the causes of this persistent gap from Los Angeles, one of the most diverse cities in the country.
Negative infinity and death word, right?
High school students Robin Choi and Jewel Prim share one key ingredient that makes them academically successful.
Ever since I can remember, college has never been a choice. It's something that's essential.
Well, my parents have always told me since I was a child that education was an investment to my career.
It's based on sales, no.
Both students attend Harvard Teacher Preparation Academy, a school that gives them as much support as they get at home. But not every school presents this type of experience. English teacher Natalie Collier says if students do not get basic academic skills by the time they reach high school, many of them become disinterested, and that is just one challenge.
The lack of motivation also comes from outside the environment. If most of the critical mass is not focused on education, then I believe it kind of trickles down and that becomes the influence.
Latino and Black students are most affected by socioeconomic challenges that keep them from excelling when compared to their white and Asian counterparts, says University of California, Los Angeles education professor Marcelo Suarez Orozco.
Both Latino children and African American children are once again attending schools that are highly segregated. They're highly segregated by race, by poverty, by language, by legal status.
All factors that contribute to an achievement gap that continues into college, says Ken O'Donnell, California State University's Senior Director of Student Engagement.
If you're the first in your generation to come to college, then that's a strike against you. We have to work harder to keep those people in school because the support networks aren't in place.
O'Donnell says the achievement gap can have lasting repercussions.
The students who come to us underprepared are likelier to drop out and likelier to take longer to graduate. And so for their life outcomes after graduation, in terms of lifetime earnings, happiness, health outcomes, all those benefits that come with earning a degree, for them are delayed by at least several years and may not happen at all.
So when we're looking at places...
At Harbor Teacher Preparation Academy, teachers begin talking about college as soon as the students start high school. They try to empower the students and provide a personalized approach to teaching, says Principal Jan Marotta.
Unless you reach that child and show that you care and get the students there and believe in them, then it makes it really difficult.
For many of today's teachers, UCLA's Suarez Orozco says reaching students means being sensitive to the cultural, linguistic, and economic barriers they face.
So knowing your students, knowing where they're coming from, knowing their communities.
But influences and responsibilities outside the classroom may continue to cause an achievement gap among Black and Hispanic students in many schools. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. He's won the FIFA Player of the Year award three times. He's won the Golden Boot as European soccer's top scorer four times. He has legions of adoring fans. And now a new documentary looks at his life off the field. International Edition's David Byrd tells us about the film Ronaldo, which looks at the life of Portuguese national and Real Madrid star Cristiano Ronaldo.
There's no arguing with Cristiano Ronaldo's skills on the football field. This year, the 30-year-old became Real Madrid's all-time leading scorer with 324 career goals. He scored 48 goals in 35 Spanish League games to win the Golden Boot for the fourth time. No other player has four of the scoring awards. He has won the Golden Ball as FIFA's Player of the Year three times and is nominated for a fourth trophy this year. But in a new documentary, Ronaldo, director Anthony Fonca takes fans behind the public sportsman to give us a glimpse of Ronaldo's life off the field. The documentary combines archival highlights with film shot over 14 months to give a look at the football star's life, particularly with his family. Cristiano Ronaldo says that he was able to relax in front of the camera, and it shows in the movie.
When I speak with the guys from Universal, they plan to do it like 3 days of filming, but I'm just feeling so comfortable and good chemistry with the director and Anthony and Paul that the thing is coming in a natural way. So in the movie that you're going to have opportunity to see that we have very intense moments, very private moments, because I was enjoying to do it the filming. So I think the last result, I think it's great. You're going to have opportunity to see it. It was unbelievable.
Director Anthony Fonca says that he was surprised by the quiet life that one of the world's top football players lives off the field.
He lives actually a relatively, you know, strict life. You know, comes home and trains and sleeps and does that. It's no mad partying, or, you know, it's and so that was a surprise. His ability to deal with pressure is actually, that's fascinating. You know, he has this, he loves it, you know, and he thrives on it. And that was for me, was fascinating.
Winning, that's the most important to me. It's as simple as that.
Ronaldo's agent Jorge Mendes said at the London premiere that the film gives fans a chance to know Cristiano the man instead of Cristiano the football star.
I think that now we have a chance to know better Cristiano. And almost of the people, I think that you don't know really who is Cristiano. Everybody knows Cristiano as a player, but as a father and out of the pitch is really, I think that you should see the movie.
Nothing is impossible, my friend.
I have what I have because I sacrifice a lot.
To do the time, difficult food.
Some people hate me. Some people love me. Fui feito para ser o melhor.
Ronaldo is produced by the same team that released documentaries on Formula One racing champion, the late Ayrton Senna of Brazil, and the late British pop singer Amy Winehouse. It is rated PG-13 and is in theaters now. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
And that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Deputy National Security Advisor Benjamin Rhodes announced on October 16th $2.2 million in new U.S. support for Laos National Mine Clearance Operator, UXOs Lao, which will enable it to rehire trained technicians it lost in 2014 as a result of funding difficulties. The UXO Lao teams will be deployed in Wampan, Sing Quang, Quan Muan, Savanakhet, Salavan, and Champasak provinces. Mr. Rhodes said that the United States is committed to helping Laos clear unexploded ordnance, or UXO, contaminated areas in order to reduce casualties and to increase the productivity of agricultural lands to reduce poverty. Mr. Rhodes recently visited a UXO Lao team clearing unexploded ordnance from Bonpaku village in Luang Prabang province. The UXO Lao team briefed Mr. Rhodes on its progress in the village and described the training that the team members must undertake in order to work in this sector. Mr. Rhodes said that he was impressed by the UXO Lao team's commitment to this work, which is so important for the Lao people and especially for the younger generation. With the new contribution, the United States will have provided more than $100 million in mine action and UXO-related assistance to Laos. Priority funding will support clearance of UXO found as a result of evidence-based survey, a cutting-edge technique that identifies contaminated areas more effectively and efficiently than ever before. Victims assistance programs will provide direct services to survivors of unexploded ordnance accidents and their families and help strengthen first aid and emergency response of key health facilities and village volunteers in heavily impacted provinces. Funding for risk awareness supports education of Lao citizens, especially children, about the dangers of UXO. USAID's Leahy War Victims Fund provided funding to the Cooperative Orthotic Prosthetic Enterprise to support physical rehabilitation programs, including prosthetics, orthotics, and mobility aids to nearly 4,500 people, including 1,500 children. The United States is proud to work with Laos and its non-governmental partners to free the people of Laos from the threat of landmines, unexploded ordnance, and other deadly remnants of war.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.